This is a Pinball News production.
Thank you, Rob. And it's always really exciting for me to get together with these guys because it was just some of the really best times of my development career. And I'm going to start this in about the year 1980. And I had just graduated from college, and I had gotten my dream job, and I started working at Williams, and it was not the Williams that you remember from the 90s that were making all the amazing pinball machines or making all the video games in Mortal Kombat. It was a really small company that had very few people in development and in operation, and actually a much larger complement in manufacturing. And they were the number two or number three pinball company on the way up. And there was a war going on at the time, or a battle, a spirited battle, where the pinballs the way they were in the electromechanical era were now converting to solid state. And there were people that really wanted and liked the things the way they were, and a lot of other people with a lot of good ideas. Here's Eugene coming in, right on time. And I'm going to introduce the cast of people that were there the day that I walked in and got involved in this battle.
I hate to interrupt you, but I just have to say, better late than never.
Sorry, go ahead.
It's okay. We told Eugene that this started at 2:30 because we know that in order to get him here on a timely basis, you've got to play some tricks. So we're seated, as Michael calls it, in our order of adoption. Our fearless leader, Mike Stroll, is on via FaceTime from California, and I hope we can hear you, Mike. Are you there? Talk to us.
Hi, everybody. And
he's here.
I am pleased to be part of the panel, and sorry that I couldn't make it there in person. I'd just like to add a few words to what Larry was saying, but before I do that, at any one of these gatherings, we must always remember that one of the truly important parts of the success of Williams Electronics was our dear friend and mentor, Steve Korda. I joined, the parent company, Seaberg, from National Semiconductor. And my real challenge was to put together a group of people to design what they called a solid-state pinball machine. I was fortunate to find David Poole, Ken Fidesna, and Ron Krause were the first employees after I became a member of Seaberg. Then followed Steve Ritchie. I found him buried in the bowels of Atari.
I heard bowels.
Hired Steve.
I don't like that.
I most hired him on the spot. I interviewed him in California with Steve Kordak. And at the end of the interview, he said to me, "You got to get this programmer. He's really good. And his name is Dr. J." I didn't know what I was getting into. But thrilled to have him. And then along came a number of other people who were people, and then we were fortunate to find Larry DeMar. And the critical group of people who actually helped Williams rise above all the waves are sitting in front of you, with the addition of Steve Kordak and Barry Osler and Connie Mitchell as the first real in-house artist.
And that was really the group when I walked in the door. And Williams has always done what it's done because of amazing people. And this was the start, but it was one amazing person after the other over 20 years. And I tip my hat a lot to Mike Strollen. We're going to hand the mic to Ken Fidesna here, who ran engineering most of the years. And really, both of them never thought about anything less than we need the greatest people, we need to find them, we need to make them happy, and we need to let them do what they do, because that's the downfall of a lot of creative stuff, is that the people in the ivory tower sometimes kind of mess things up. So Kenny?
So Larry, I just would like to clarify one thing you said. When we moved from the old Seaberg building into Williams, the new group was called the Advanced Development Group. And there truly was friction between the existing pinball guys and, quote, the Advanced Development Group, with the exception of Steve Kordak, who really fell in line and was effectively adopted us. And they called us the Advanced Development Team, and they called themselves the Backward Development Team. Now I'm done.
Well, just to add to that, I don't know if, Mike, if you remember this, but there wasn't just friction between us and the Williams people. It was also even friction in a group such that Mike nicknamed us the Sandbox Kids, because we were always throwing sand at each other and always fighting between Dave Poole and Ron and I, and Mike would always have to break us up, if you remember those stories. So I think that's part of what I learned from back then, was that I was one of the original Sandbox Kids. So then when Steve and Eugene and Ed Boone and Larry and all these other guys joined Williams and things like that, I think I had a certain association with you guys because I was the original Sandbox Kid, as it turned out. But that was 1977, as Mike said. We started, February 21st is when I started, and I remember that the goal was to have the first solid-state pinball machine out by Memorial Day, which is 3 months, and we did it. We pulled it off. We designed electronic circuitry from scratch. We did the layouts of the board. We wired 5 Grand Prix machines at the time. We took electromechanical Steve Kordak games. We did them to all the thing, and we had those 5 games out on Memorial Day of 1977. So it's 40 years now that it goes back at that time.
When I hired Ken, you heard how crunchy the schedule was. When I hired him, he was sitting in the office that I had at the Seaberg building, and he looked at me and he said, "Okay, I don't know what I'll be doing, but I'm coming."
Well, there's another couple stories. The first time that I met Mike at Seaberg and that, I was being escorted, and this was when Seaberg was on Clybourne Avenue, not that far from Caprini Green, which was not exactly the best of neighborhoods and things like that. And I rolled up into the parking lot, and they had all this barbed wire and guards and things like that. And as they're walking me up to the office to meet with Mike, we're walking through this hallway, and the guard points out these bullet holes that were in the hallway they were going up. And I guess there was some fight that somebody tried to rob Seaver one time, and there was actually a gun battle. So I'm walking up to go meet with Mike, and I'm saying, what am I getting myself into? This is crazy. I should be out of here. But I stayed and was there till 2005 with the combination of companies, I should say.
And an example where we were talking about the old school and the new school, I got to Williams when these two guys had just finished up doing Firepower. And really, Flash and Firepower were like the stepping stones out of the you hit a switch and a score changes to, hey, we can do some stuff. And Eugene was telling me the story, and I'll let him do it, but about where did the score go when you did the special effect? It was like, oh, my God.
Yeah, there was, programming was at a very crude state in 1979, and actually, it's a funny story. When I started Atari, the previous programmer had told people it was impossible to flash lights, and because you'd lose the state of the light, so it was just impossible. And people go, "Okay, it's impossible," you know. And so I flashed a light, and then I became Dr. J. That was huge. But then at Williams, we were doing actually on Firepower the first. I mean, this sounds incredibly lame, but the first score effect, and where we took out the score and we counted down, you know, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and shot the multi-ball out, and people were just like, "Dude, you can't do that, man! Like the score is gone, you know, like it's like it's like where did it go?" It's
like, also, this it's like. This guy is totally innovative. Everybody is at the table, just in different areas. But Eugene is like off the wall. He has a really special talent for bringing forth the unexpected. There you go. We worked together for a long time at Firepower. We worked really hard. And one night we were playing it, and we just knew. I mean, it sounds big-headed, but come on, we had worked on that thing for a long time. We just knew it was a great game, and we played it, and we smiled, and we had a good time. And that night, I had the best game of pinball I ever had in my life. I could do no wrong. It lasted a half an hour, 40 minutes. I haven't played a game since then. I'm not bragging on Firepower. I'm just saying that it was fun.
Your body was possessed by the spirit of Roger Sharp for an evening.
Well, it's funny, you know, you talk about rivalries, and I think when Steve came in, it was in 1978, to Williams, I still wasn't there, but basically it was Steve Ritchie against everyone, you know what I'm saying? And, you know, Steve was just like, he questioned everything, you know, like, hey, what, you know, why do we have, you know, really shitty drop targets that don't work? And I was like, well, because we always had those, what the fuck, you know, it's like, well, fucking fix them, like... Dude, man,
speaking of drive targets, you know, when we finished Firepower, it wasn't really finished because we had drop targets, two rows of drop targets that Eugene was just talking about, and, you know, we really wanted the drop targets, but they had these stupid horseshoe things on them, and they were horrible. It had nothing to do with any of us, including Mike. The design existed when we got there, pretty horrible, and, so I'm telling Mike, I really want these drop targets on there. And he goes, if you put those drop targets on there, we're probably going to sell half the games. And I said, okay, we don't need drop targets. We don't need them.
This, you ever see a sad puppy when he's like pooed on the carpet and he's got his tail between his legs? I was there. It was right when Mike made the decision and these guys were told that there would not be drop targets. And the action in Firepower off the two banks with the drop targets was magnificent, and it really
it was an accident.
It really changed, like most of your layouts. Yeah.
Can I talk about you for a
please.
Minute?
Please.
Okay. So Eugene and I are there, and we just finished Firepower, and Larry is like a punk. He comes in, he's a street urchin. He knows street pinball better than we do because he's been playing it for a long time on the street. And let's just say, none of those games made a lot of money. Penny stacking. I'm not going to go into it. But he taught us some very interesting things in a completely different perspective of the business. I mean, it's all fun and games. You know, you can go to an arcade once in a while, but you spend most of the time, you know, cranking out a game, working on some rules or some new ideas or a different shot or device. So I'm just going to say this. We did some bad things, too. Terrible. Once I was...
And now we'd like to have another word from Ken.
Moving right along here.
Okay, once I was in the hall outside Barry Osler's office, and I had a bottle rocket in my hand. I put it down on the floor right in front of his closed door, and there's a gap about that big. I lit it on fire, and it goes, bam, like that, in Gary's office. And he goes, you bastard, like that. Anyway, Ken Fidesna saw me do it, and I thought, okay, I'm probably going to be in trouble. And he goes, you burned the floor. Put a piece of metal under it next time.
And then, of course, the epic rubber band fights in the factory after hours, you know, where you get a like a ruler and, you know, with about 12-inch slingshot rubbers. And, you know, I think there was some permanent facial reorganizations from that. But that was, you know, just to break the ice and, I don't know, did we ever work?
Yeah, we worked. But I do want to say this. For a while, he was calling me Alzheimer's. I was pissed off about it. I didn't like to be called Alzheimer's. Okay? So I made a sign for his door, and it said, Dr. Doolittle, and little will be done.
All right. You got me. All right. but there were some other shenanigans. I remember there was this thing called toilet fish, which were... these 3-foot goldfish that lived in the Chicago River. And Steve had a special way of fishing for them. He would throw a M80 into the Chicago River, and then they'd all come floating up. And you know,
I heard most of it.
Right? Is your is that why your hearing is a little messed up today? Or
what did you just say?
Was he
talking about an M1000 incident?
I was going to say, it wasn't an M80. It was a quarter stick of
dynamite. M1000. Here's the stupid thing. Like, he has my lighter, and I go like this. It's right here by my head. Go ahead, do it. I made such a huge explosion. I think we did more than one, but maybe not in the river. I don't know. What else can I say? I can say this. I can say...
It looks like now it's time to take a question.
No, I just want to say this. There was a lot of love generated at Williams, too. Tons. Those of us that worked there and together, it was totally awesome. It was a group of such great people. So, I don't know, Pat Lawler's here, but think about that guy. And think about how he is here. How about that? Okay, but think about, you know, all the programmers. Dwight was there. Just a huge group. Dennis Nordman. Jim Patla. Wow. The
George,
artist.
Ed Boone.
Yeah. Name some.
Brian.
George Petro.
George Petro.
Ron Krause, who was the guy who invented the V-ball, which when you got multi-ball and firepower, you just put your hands up.
Which was created by Ron and Tom Cahill to piss off Steve.
My brother Mark. Wait, who pissed me off?
Tom Cahill and Ron Krause with V-Ball.
Oh, V-Ball, that's right. That was kind of crazy. I didn't understand that.
How many played firepower back when it was new? Okay, because if you're... if you're newer to pinball than that era, you don't kind of get how special firepower was. It really was the, in my view, the turning point of going from what pinballs were their whole life to what could we do with them. And the celebration for the multi-ball kickout, which again, had all the traditional people very concerned. Where did the score go? What are we going to do? It was a big deal. Everyone was excited about it. And Ron and Tom Cahill, to pull Steve's chain, when they'd throw the ball in and this big thing would start and you're about to get all the balls to come out in the exciting time in the game, they would just turn around and go, V-ball! And let the balls kick out.
Them drain.
And not look at what was going on. And it was really just... And
I think it's odd that some people would even think it's a little bit funny.
And it caught on, okay? It became a thing. We used to play... The pinball machines, they were up by the cafeteria in that era. And so, oh, and we had a lunchroom at Williams where we would get together with people we liked and people we didn't like, and it was a wonderful
Friday. Was awesome. Friday was hot dog day. Millie, right? Millie, the cook.
Millie Lawrence.
And she had like foot long hot dogs. And these were really foot long hot dogs. But it reminds me of a story of a guy that was our sales guy at the time, which Jack Middle. And the weird thing was, I remember later days at Williams, the sales and marketing department was like 300 people. And in this era, in like 1979, there was one guy on a phone. His name was Jack Middle, and he somehow sold everything. And super, super very thin guy, and he had a way of talking to you. He would kind of get into your
2 inches away.
He'd get into
about
your
two
space.
Inches like this. It's kinda a little like, uncomfortable, Jack. Like, just a little.
And but you know, it was a way of kind of getting the truth out of people. But he was a wonderful guy, and he. But the weirdest thing, he had this habit. He would he was really skinny, and watched his diet. But the one thing he had a weakness for was cherry pie. And they would have the cherry pies would be out on the counter in the cafeteria. And he would get a toothpick and pick the cherries out of each piece. And then just kind of walk away, you know, just because they're there, you know. But Jack was an amazing guy and a terrific, terrific sales guy.
Group of us together could ever get through this without Ken telling the story of the great high-speed encounter.
Something about a machine being thrown on someone or something. Was this?
You weren't there.
I don't remember exactly what the... I know what the story is, but I don't remember exactly why you and I got into this big argument. But we were arguing about high-speed. And you know what we were arguing about? Okay. Do you know what we were arguing about?
I'll just say this. We're in the lab together, and Larry and I are working on stuff, and it's like high speed, we know, is going to be a real innovative game. We came up with a lot of things for that, automatic percentaging, where you didn't have to go out and reset, you know, little pins and holes, so it would adjust the score to the abilities and the, you know, and the desires of the operator. Also, it could heal itself. Targets that were broken would take themselves out of the list. You only had to get two targets instead of three if only one was bad. And we wanted to communicate more to the player. We wanted, you know, we wanted to tell him stuff. And so Larry and I thought, hey, we want an alphanumeric display. I think we had one on Hyperball, right?
Right. There was one on Hyperball. And displays were just all numbers, just like their predecessors. They just had 7-segment numeric displays.
Right.
And we had found these cool displays that only cost twice as much as the old ones.
Yeah, so we are also doing this.
So Ken was very cool with the cost, wasn't he? No.
Say it now so I can hear you. Say it. Ken was cool with the cost. Right. Anyway, so Ken comes in, and I guess, you know, Larry's adamant about getting this thing. And, I want it too, but it's like, I think maybe that day you were just kind of fed up, and that was it. You know,
we were having a discussion, and the discussion got a little bigger, and it got a little bigger, and I was explaining the merits and what we could do and all the things, and I got an eye roll at the wrong time, and the discussion is such where literally. I'm standing here, the prototype game is there, Ken is right there. And in the middle of the discussion, the game started to move.
Like on him. And he's going, don't you dare do that, put that back.
And Ken was in charge, okay? This was, you know, we had the daycare supervisor, and we had the children that worked at the company.
The sandbox kids.
Yeah.
Now, Larry, was that when you demanded that they put your salary into escrow? Was it?
I was told in no uncertain terms that we're not doing it. It's too expensive. We'll never ever sell a game. And I, like the day Steve lost his drop targets, was walking around with my tail between my legs and pouting around. And I actually, nobody knows this to this day, but I left that day and I didn't come in for 3 days. And I was just so angry about this, and nobody at Williams noticed they or just, said a word.
They just thought Larry was with Python.
And I came back, and what's interesting is at the end of the day, we ended up with two alphanumeric displays on top and two numeric displays on the bottom, which was pretty much a compromise of what the two sides wanted. It was as powerful and great for our ability to communicate to the player and expand rules and to move the bonus to the back glass off of the light string. Yeah. And to have this jackpot feature, which was the first of its time. So it all worked out great, and we compromised to get
jackpot,
through it.
I should have. There's another thing I want to say, too, about Ken. It's like, I mean, and Mike, neither one of them ever really told us what to do, what to make. Sometimes some suggestions, they let us do what we were good at, and I very much appreciate that. So does he's got.
For these guys, we wouldn't have been what we were. And if we didn't let you guys create, that was the whole premise. And it was the group of people that we had. All you guys bouncing ideas off each other and everything else really made it happen.
I see a lot of faces out there that we worked with. Everybody that worked with us, stand up, please. There's a bunch of you in the audience, and this is part of the great, 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 great group of Williams designers and engineers. We've got Dennis, Dwight, Duncan, Pat, Mike, Roger, Greg, Jim. If I missed you, I'm sorry. We'll say Dennis again. Thank you guys, because working at Williams was with all of the amazing people, and all the stuff we were able to do was one of the greatest times of my life.
You know, I think what made Williams so special, I think, was the spirit of like innovation, to do something new, to prove something new to the world, and it all was fostered and inspired by Mike Stroll. I mean, Mike, you know, just had the audacity to say, you know, hey, you know, and when the solid state pinball started, the hot game was called Hot Tip, right? And you know, it was hot, you know, but but from there, I think Mike's vision of, hey, let's take this as far as we can, let's get the craziest people we can, let's push things forward, you know, and then obviously bringing Steve Ritchie, who was even more pushy, and I think it just that drove the thing, and I mean, I love the spirit of, you know, certainly Steve Ritchie is like, that's not good enough, make it better, make it alphanumeric. This flipper isn't strong enough. Flipper still isn't strong enough. You know, I think finally when the play field started, you know, the post started flying off and things started destructing, it finally was a strong enough flipper.
Star Trek, what do you mean? What do you
think? Flippers. Flippers?
The flippers?
Yeah.
What about them?
Get strong enough.
No, they were definitely not strong enough on Black Knight. This was the call. Ready? More power! More! Bigger! Better! Stronger!
But Steve Ritchie. But I think, you know, Mike also had the audacity to just go out there and announce to the industry, like, next year we're going to have the number one pinball game in the industry. Our last one was number 38. But next year it's going to be number one. And, like, I don't know how we knew that, but somehow we had to make the number one pinball game, and we did. And then, you know, the next year says, we're going to have the number one pinball game and the number one video game. And like, yeah. I don't know, man.
Mike was a bit of a magician, and he really cast a spell over all of us. There was something about the relationship, the way he was, the respect, and whatever else. But everybody at that company wanted to impress and please Mike, and that extended to when we had conflicts, because like Steve and I worked together on a couple of games, we never had any conflicts.
And when that happened, and you know, we're all very passionate about what we do. The best designers are all very insecure. The reason their games are so great is because you really need to design up to here to be good, and you need to design up to here to be great, and we never quite know where that bar is, so we design it up to about here. Which is, and it's out of insecurity. It's oh my God, I don't want to be good. I don't want to fail. And so the greatest designers are insecure and passionate, and sometimes that creates some personality conflicts. And we had some doozies.
We did.
And Mike, we would go in, and Mike would. You'd get into his magic force field, and all of a sudden, la-di-da, kumbaya, it was really okay now. It was magic, and we were possessed. I can't describe it any differently.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I remember it a little differently. I don't. Did Steve, did you ever have the same programmer twice on any game? You know, on your next game, it's always like, you know, whatever, it's always the last project I'll ever do with what's his name. And
you did three games with me. You did three games with me. Well, maybe four. Yeah. You did. Airborne Avengers, Superman, Firepower, and F-14 Tomcat. No, you're not getting the mic.
There was like about a 10-year gap between some of those, Steve. I mean, you know, you're tough on programmers, man. I mean,
the trouble with programmers is they don't always do what I say. And often, that's a good thing.
Do we have any questions?
Yeah, I did a lot of sounds for Williams back in the day. You'd really have to say Flash had some huge innovations. Actually, as far as pyrotechnic effects, the Flash lamp, which is a visual effect, and
still used on every game since.
Still used on every game. I guess it's basically an automotive blinker light. And that was huge, the lightning.
You're showing your age. I'm sure they're LEDs now.
Oh, yeah, right. Right.
Stern
okay.
Guys.
Yeah, maybe, yeah. Okay. But this we're talking about back in the day now. The other, obviously the background sound, okay, was huge, huge. And I believe this was something Steve Ritchie was insistent upon. And I think it was
legendary. Wasn't there a war fought over that and adjustments and chime mode and all that stuff?
Didn't you lose Randy Pfeiffer over this?
No.
I'm still a guitar player. I don't play all that often, but I'm still playing. And I had an Echoplex unit that I used to plug my guitar into, and then that into my amplifier. And it was really crude. It was echo, but it was like tape echo. It had heads that you could slide closer together so you could, you know, it would go hello, 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 or you could make it go, you could say hello, hello. It would be totally variable time and duration, and one time we just stuck it on Superman. We stuck it in between the amp and the speaker, and it was very cool, but, you know, I don't think anybody else liked it except Eugene and I.
I think that was after we we're smoking a little bit.
Yeah, listen, before it, the smoking event? Okay, Mike, do you remember a smoking event? Mike Stroll.
I'm sorry, I can't understand you.
Okay, I know. I can't understand anybody either. Okay, so it's like, do you remember?
Say it again.
Do you remember a late night smoking incident at Williams?
Larry, help.
Do you remember a late night smoking incident at Williams?
With Doug? You and Doug? Sitting in the back of my office?
It wasn't me and Doug. It was me and Dr. J. Oh,
I walked out of my office and I walked into the area where he and Doug were sitting, and there was this haze of smoke that smelled funny. And I looked at him and said, "This is not a tart." put it out and don't ever do it again. I turned around and I walked out.
I just want to say that, Mike, I just want to say that we never did that again. Now, I have another story to talk about. What? One more story. We talked about high speed tonight. Okay, high speed was kind of late. Like Larry and I were down on the line fixing stuff, making the code. You look at me like, what?
I'm trying to dial
it, in. It was late. We were late, and Ken didn't yell much. I heard him say the worst language I ever heard him say when a boat went between Bridget and my boat when we were water skiing at Fox Lake. That's the worst language I ever heard Ken use. But there was, do you remember? Okay. But then Ken did get a little animated, okay, when we were kind of late. And so Larry and I worked really hard into the Christmas vacation. Into the vacation, and it's like, we can go.
I remember specifically that...
No, I'm going to say that.
I remember specifically I was... The Williams Christmas gathering, it was upstairs in what was that cafeteria area still.
Yes.
And I was behind the door because we were in exile on the west side of the building, if you
right.
remember. And I was behind there working on the manual addendum to get the manual finished for the late production while everybody was in there, you know, having a party. I just remember that vividly.
Yeah. Anyway, high speed rock. I think we sold like 17,500. I don't know. He knows. There's the International Pinball Database. Anyway, but here's what I wanted to say. Later on, you know, we'd be working on a game, and one time Ken screamed out, "We don't want another high speed." We did. We wanted another high speed.
Right, working on another game. Usually like on F-14. When you're working at
F-14.
Yeah, right. Yeah, we don't want to make that mistake again and sell 17,000 games. Oh, screw yeah. that. Man. Too much work, right, Ken?
Yep.
Got to pay the bills. Keep those 17,000 run.
But you know, I think kind of a cool spirit of Williams, and as, you know, epitomized by Mike Stroll and Steve Ritchie, was that every game... We wanted to do something new, make it like the greatest game that had been made at that point. You know, starting with Flash, with the background sound, the amazing electronic sounds, the flash effect, beautiful artwork by Constantino Mitchell, amazing theme. Firepower, the first multi-ball game of the electronic era. Then Black Knight, the first really multi-level game, maybe. Gorgar, that's right.
Gorgar.
First talking.
Me got you.
The first time I played Gorgar, I went to see it on test because I had heard about it. I didn't know the name of the game. I knew Williams had done a talking pinball, and I went out to Mother's Pinball in Mount Prospect. I played a game, and I wasn't sure I had heard a talking pinball because the speech was so unintelligible.
Wait. This guy right here is the pioneer of pinball audio. There's no question. Right. No one else even comes close. And then,
well, but Gorgar's speech show, Paul DeSalt had a huge part of
that. What
you
made me do. No.
What?
We worked on it together. Nobody made anybody do any. Oh, double mic. I like it. Okay, so it's in stereo, maybe. Okay, so what we did was, this is probably really loud and hurtful. Okay, so... what we did with audio was I had to say everything in a monotone voice. I think we had like 13 seconds, so I had to go, "Fire, power, you are destroyed, enemy." Enemy destroyed. I don't know. I just said it really.
The reason it had to be a monotone was because we had so little space for speech. We took the words and put them in different order. Right. Mission accomplished, you right. won one mission. Right. The W-O-N-O-N-E from there is the same as fire one, fire two, fire three.
Right.
Word you hear fire is the fire from firepower. And so everything had to be monotone so we could mix and match the syllables to take 14 whole seconds of speech and make it a whole game soundtrack.
But yeah, that was an incredible feat by Ken Fidessa and the hardware department, and also Paul DeSalt was the programmer. I did the heartbeat though. Ba boom, 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 ba boom. And it was a cardiac arrest at the end of that game. That's kind of cool. But you know, and I think, you know, you look at High Speed, another legendary piece in the Williams lineup, and again, it was like probably the first really incredibly themed pinball game. You know, to really have a story, to have a theme. You know, with the alphanumeric display, you know, that was pretty incredible. Jackpot, and then, you know, going on to Pinbot, which was another legendary a game. So every game we tried to make to be the best and most crazy game ever.
Yeah, when we did High Speed, Steve said, let's take this horrible speech system and out to the parking lot and record our cars to make car sounds. And I'm like, Steve, it'll never work. And I mean, you've heard it. It sounds much better than the speech in the game. And that was my 1982 Trans Am.
Yeah,
that's right. That we used for Marshall, the sounds of the game.
His Marshall guitar in there, too.
Right. We a guy named Bill Parade came up with a magnificent piece of software that sampled one guitar note, because again, we had no memory, we had no place to put any data, no room for a big program. Didn't have a synthesizer. He sampled one guitar note in that sound system and then used different playback rates to pitch it to play a guitar riff that Steve wrote and the band really used to play.
It really worked well with Black Knight 2000. That was Dan Forden and Brian Schmidt and myself. All of us wrote it, but they programmed it. And I don't know, it sounded really nice.
But I guess, you know, it all wasn't fun in games. I mean, there was some rivalries. I remember the... you know, and Steve may not even admit this, but, you know, there was a little bit of rivalry between Steve Kordick and Steve Ritchie. And, you know, kind of the new guard and the old guard. And I remember when I came to work in 1979 and Steve Ritchie introduced me to Steve Kordick and said, hey, you know, this is the guy. And then we're walking down the hallway and he goes, you know what, a couple of years I'm going to take his job, you know. And
I never said that. He's lying.
And then...
I really never got his job.
Yeah, exactly. His 30 years later, you didn't have a job.
His job was chief engineer. His job was chief engineer when pinball had chief engineers. We don't have a chief engineer anymore who dictates code or the rules of the game or what the game should be. We become sort of like, you know, team project leaders. That's about it.
Right.
I'm not saying that we still don't do all the things that we did. We do. Well, maybe not in Eugene's case. He's a pencil pusher now. I'd like to know when he wrote his last line of code. It was probably like 10 years ago.
Well, we always said that you're only as good as your last line of code, you know. And I guess mine is a no-op right now. But, you know, there was a rivalry for resources, you know. And there was always
a rat race?
A struggle for resources.
Okay, right.
You know,
competition for resources.
You know, Kenny's taking all my mechanical guys, and he's putting on, you know, on Osler's project, and blah, blah, blah. You know, and there's always this kind of this push, give and take, this push of trying to get your project going, because everybody's trying to get their project going.
Especially in the 90s when we had like 6 or 8 teams.
Yeah.
George Gomez used to call it warring gangs, and you were competing for the projects, for the licenses, for the production slots. Right. Engineers wanted to get designers wanted to get the best programmers and mechanical engineers and sound guys. And
I just want to say one word here. Yeah. One word. Ready? The Boneyard.
Popeye's chicken.
Oh yeah. So yeah, that's a cool one. So it's still there. Popeye's chicken at California and Diversity. And there was I don't know, they may have remodeled it, but there was a booth in the corner, and there was a big planter right behind the booth, and you could just kind of take your chicken bones and just chuck them back.
You have to have the prime seat. You got to be able to see the window where they have the food people, and then all the rest of the patrons. Okay, so you have to be looking at all of them and bink like that.
I was there last week. They're still there in the planter.
That plant is really big now. Yeah, that was. Why did we do that, Steve?
Say it again.
Why did we do that?
I don't know. Think about George Petro. He used to go to McDonald's. He'd buy
White Castle.
He'd buy a quarter pounder, take the pickle out with the mustard and ketchup on it, and launch it in a certain way so it would stick up on the glass and then slide down slowly.
That's right. If you can get if you can get 7 or 8 of them up there, he'd always order extra pickles. But it was amazing. You do it late at night, typically, so nobody, there wasn't a lot of people around. But you could get this full lineup of pickles just sliding down the window, and they would slide down at a very slow rate.
I was with him at the White Castle out by the Carroll Stream test location, Galen North.
Okay.
And I'd never seen this or heard this before. I laughed so hard, I literally almost peed in my pants. It was when he took...
That was crazy.
I started taking questions and then I kind of fell off the wagon.
Going to trade shows?
You want to take that, yeah. Michael? What about going to trade shows?
Get a huge game.
It was one of the coolest things ever. Probably the coolest thing about doing this is when you see people playing your game and laughing and having fun and really, just really over the top enjoying themselves. And the trade show was just a great, great game. First look. Of all of those experiences, I'll never forget when they first put Defender out.
Mm-hmm.
That
was a Conrad Hilton 1980, and it was kind of bizarre. The weirdest thing is the entire trade show was probably in this room. I mean, it was that small. I mean, it was very low key. It was very kind of old school. And the weirdest thing I remember in those days, you would Williams had a tailor, and I guess because none of the programmers had anything other than T-shirts. So they would actually give you a blazer, right? Maybe even pants, because we only had shorts, But they would dress us up in these suits and pants and stuff. I still wear one today. I mean, but the show was very in 79. It was 80. It was a very kind of old school basement of the Hilton down on the south side. And the booths were incredibly small in those days. They were just 10 by 10, 10 by 20. Oops. Okay. Pat Lawler. Get up here, Barney. Come on.
Hello? I'm the wrong era. I came to Williams after these guys had made it great, and so, well, I followed in their footsteps, and the best thing about I was sitting back there listening to all this, and there were two things that struck me. First of all, how many years later is this? No one's missed a beat. You haven't missed a beat. You could all go back to work again the day after tomorrow. And it would be just like it was. None of you've missed a beat, okay? And the other thing about Williams that made it special that Larry taught me about Mr. Stroll was that all they cared about was build something cool, right? And you know how hard that is for management to do in any kind of company? Management wants to tell you what to do. They don't want to just let you do it, right? But Williams lets you do it. And the day I went to work there, I was one of the, they tell you when you buy a boat, it's the happiest day. It was the happiest day of my life. I got to be, I got to work with people whose games I'd played for years, and these guys are gods. They were gods. I played Defender on location, and I met these guys, and I said, oh, my God, I'm meeting the guys who made Defender. Are you kidding me? And it was awesome. And Steve Ritchie, I played all of Steve's games that he just talked about on location, and I'll never forget, I played one of your games, and I turned to the arcade. I'm trying to remember which one it was.
Very memorable.
It was memorable. It was memorable.
But I can't remember the name of it.
It was Firepower, and I turned to the It was up at Mother's because everybody played at Mother's, and I said to the guy there, "This is the coolest game ever. This is the coolest pinball machine ever." And the guy went, "It makes a lot of money." So. You know, he got it. So I would just like to say I was back there laughing like you were. It was an honor. I got to work with all of these people.
Well, hey, okay, Pat, stay up here, though, because you talk about cool pinball games. I mean, you and Larry, Adam's family, I mean, this is the greatest selling pinball game ever, also probably the funnest pinball game ever. So tell us something, man.
No, that... Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
No, I mean, amazing game. I mean, what was the magic there?
The thing.
Insecurity.
Right.
Insecurity. That's what drives it. And sometimes like a 9 to 8 crazy 4-5 hour Cubs game, things just fall together in the end.
Right.
You also, I mean, it's really like a really wise license choice. Dun-dun-dun-dun. That's
right.
So cool. I mean, it's like, it's a connection to a huge group of people.
Licenses, mysenses.
The mamushka.
The mamushka.
But what about, and what about Banzai Run, which is pretty incredible, probably one of the most innovative games ever.
But you guys have all heard me talk about Banzai Run before, so I'm just, in case you haven't heard me say this before, Banzai Run is all due to him. Okay, I had a crazy idea, but if it weren't for him, there would be no Banzai Run. So, you know, Larry made that whole thing happen.
You're right. You know, I told Mike, don't hire this guy.
So yeah, it Adams was cool. You know, to go back to Adams. Adams was cool because we took a theme and we went out of our way to make sure. This is what happens now. You know, all pinball machines are this way now, right? But we took a theme and we took it to an extreme. We made sure that what you remembered from the TV show and the movie was in the game, and that just resonated with people all over. You know, all over the world that played it. When it's like Steve said, you walked up to it, you went da 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 da. Right, and you know you expected that in the game, and how many games have you guys played in the other room? You know, older games that might have a theme in them, and you get done and you go, well, it's got a picture on the box, right? Because the people who built it didn't bother to put the theme in the game, and you know we made sure we put the theme in the game.
We've got a minute or two left, I think, so we'll take a question or two, and then we're going to wrap it up. That's my doing. I think it was every 10 or 15 end of balls that it would do it. This was about, what, 35 years ago? 25 years ago, the doing things randomly was in my playbook, so I won't swear, but my best memory is it just went every 10 or 15, some set number of balls. Mike, how did you find Steve Ritchie in the bowels, and what were you doing in the bowels of Atari?
I saw Atari came out with a wide body machine called Superman, and I tried to find out who designed Superman, and somehow or other I did, and I spoke to him, and I asked him if he would like to talk to Steve Kordak and myself, we were coming into California. And he said, no, he's not going to leave, but there's this young technician who has a desire to become a pinball designer. You should talk to him, Steve Ritchie.
Legend has it that you offered to double his salary. Is there any truth to that?
Pardon?
You doubled his salary to have him come out? Is there any truth to that?
That's a long story, and you're going to have to get the truth from Steve.
Aren't we kind of going over time here?
Yeah.
All right.
You got to hear the story.
Okay.
You want me to tell
Steve
you
Epstein
story?
Has a question.
I'm not going to expose Steve.
Nice and loud. Wait, I thought of another thing. Remember when we used to sit on the stairs at the bottom of engineering? Yeah, we did that too sometimes, but we did it more. We definitely talked about a game very much like you made, a driving game. Cruising, but we also talked about the $10,000 pinball machine. Well, we're there now. We're there.
Thank you, Pat.
That was. We'd also watched the rats come out of the building at late at night. I mean, there were some interesting things that happened over there.
All right, we're going to wrap it up. You guys have been fantastic. Thank you for spending the time with us. We want to have everyone from Williams that worked with us to come on up for a big group picture for Jim. For a number of us. Okay, all the Williams people, Steve Epstein, you're part of that crowd. And thank you, everyone.